It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's election day. This morning we'll remind you of the basics you need to cast your ballot today. The polls open until 8 tonight when they close. Wisconsin Public Media's Sean Johnson, Frederica Freiberg, and Rob Ferret anchor WPR's coverage of statewide elections, including the races for governor and U.S. senator. NPR reports on national races will start at 7 o'clock. We'll be here throughout the night with election results and analysis. That's live election night coverage starting at 7 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Radio. Now, after nearly a decade in orbit and over 2,600 planet discoveries, the Kepler Space Telescope has run out of gas and been officially decommissioned by NASA. But that doesn't mean that the hunt for more planets is over. A science writer joins us to talk about the impact of Kepler on the world of astronomy and what's next in the search for planets outside of our solar system. What questions do you have about the hunt to find new planets? Do you follow the discoveries of the Kepler Space Telescope, and will you miss it? What can we learn about our own home in the universe from these kinds of discoveries, do you think? And when it comes to searching for life elsewhere, where do you think we should focus that hunt? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can find us on Twitter at WPR Mornings. Nadia Drake is a science journalist and a contributing writer for National Geographic, where, among other things, she writes about space. She was also the science writer in residence at UW-Madison in the fall of 2016. Nadia, welcome to the morning show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So, as we mentioned, the space telescope known as Kepler is shutting down after nearly a decade of service. Give us a sense of Kepler's mission and why NASA was looking to what NASA was looking to accomplish with this craft.
So Kepler's mission, so it was launched in 2009, and its goal was basically to take a census of all of the exoplanets orbiting several hundred thousand stars in one small patch of sky, with the ultimate goal to figure out how common Earths are. So what percentage of exoplanets might be rocky, like ours, and at a distance from their star where it's neither too hot nor too cold for water to be stable on a planet's surface, just like ours. And what Kepler ended up finding out was that there are more planets than stars in the sky, which, if you think about it, is just kind of mind-boggling, given that we didn't even know that planets orbited other stars until about 25 years ago.
What is an exoplanet?
An exoplanet is a planet that orbits a star other than the sun. So planets that orbit stars that are very far away, something that's not in our solar system.
9 years, that seems like a pretty good run for a piece of technology we shot into space. Was this about the expected lifespan of Kepler, or did it go beyond expectations?
That's a good point. So Kepler's primary mission lasted for about 4 years, and then they kept getting mission extensions. So ultimately, the space telescope was observing for, I think, longer than the primary mission was initially designed to do. But what engineers have said is that the spacecraft ran out of fuel right on time. So they'd been anticipating the end of the mission. They'd been able to see what the fuel reserves were like, and they could see that the gas tank was getting low.
Nadia Drake is a science journalist and contributing writer for National Geographic, where, among other things, she writes about space. What questions do you have about the hunt to find new planets? Did you follow the discoveries of the Kepler Space Telescope? Will you miss it? Is it mind-boggling to you that there are more planets out there than there are stars in the sky? And what does that make you think of when you hear a statistic like that? What do you think we can learn about our own home in the universe from these kinds of discoveries? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 is the number to call to share your thoughts. You can also share them with us via email, ideas@wpr.org, or on Twitter, at WPR Mornings. The big statistic here is that Kepler helped in the discovery of over 2,600 planets outside the solar system. How big a deal is that?
It's huge. So Kepler, over its roughly 9.5 years, has discovered, as you said, it's 2,662 planets outside the solar system. They have another 4,000 planet candidates that need to be confirmed as being actual worlds. And if you look at the total number of planets outside the solar system that have been discovered so far over the last nearly 25 years, that total is only about 3,800. So Kepler has discovered the vast majority of planets that we know about that orbit stars other than our sun.
It's not like these planets are easily seen. I mean, they don't generate their own light like a star would. How did Kepler discover them?
So Kepler was using what's called the transit method to search for planets. And what that means is that the spacecraft was looking for the brief blips in starlight caused by planets moving across the faces of their stars. And when they do that, they briefly block a tiny portion of the star's light. And so from the frequency and the duration and the intensity of that brief dimming event, scientists can figure out how wide a planet is and how far from the star it orbits. And so Kepler did that by basically engaging in the most epic staring contest you can imagine, where it just stared at this one patch of star-studded sky for 4 years and looked for these brief dimming events caused by planets passing between their stars and Earth.
Discovering thousands of planets sounds, well, really fascinating and interesting and good, but, I mean, it's not like we're going to be able to visit these places anytime soon. In fact, not for a very, very long time. So what's the benefit of making these discoveries and knowing about these planets?
Now, I wish we could go see them, right? So one of the questions that we have, which I think is one of the most profound questions that humans can be asking, is whether we are alone in the universe or whether the cosmic ocean is as richly populated as the seas on Earth. Is there life out there? And so far, what we know about life is that life likes to live on a planet. And so if we know that the cosmos is stuffed with planets, which Kepler has told us it is, then that means there are many, many, many possible abodes for alien life out there.
And even though Kepler will no longer send any new information, I understand that there's still plenty of old data from the space telescope that NASA hasn't even touched yet. What do we know about that?
So 9.5 years of data is quite a lot. And what scientists are going to be doing is looking through the data that the spacecraft has beamed back down to Earth and trying to understand the planetary system that Kepler observed. One of the things that the spacecraft told us is that planets don't really like to live alone. You don't really see planets orbiting stars by themselves. Instead, they like to have planetary siblings. And one of the big questions that scientists have now is, how are planetary systems put together? What kinds of architectures do we see? And if we can understand those systems, we can start to figure out whether our solar system is common or maybe it's abnormal, maybe it's an anomaly. And those are the kinds of questions that scientists are going to be looking through the Kepler data and trying to answer with all of the data that the spacecraft has produced.
Nadia Drake is a science journalist and contributing writer for National Geographic. We're talking with her this morning about post-Kepler planet hunting. Our conversation will continue in a moment. What questions do you have about the hunt to find new planets? And did you follow the discoveries of the Kepler Space Telescope? Will you miss having that information? What do you think we can learn about our own planet from looking for these kinds of discoveries? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. After nearly a decade in orbit and over 2,600 planet discoveries, the Kepler Space Telescope has run out of fuel and has been officially decommissioned by NASA. But that doesn't mean that the hunt for more planets is over. What questions do you have about the hunt to find new planets? And what do you think we can learn about our own home in the universe from these kinds of discoveries? When it comes to searching for life elsewhere, where do you think we should focus that hunt? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email address ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Nadia Drake is here to talk with us about this subject. She's a science journalist and contributing writer for National Geographic. She was also the science writer in residence at UW-Madison in the fall of 2016. Nadia, earlier this year, NASA launched Kepler's replacement, so to speak, into space. It's known as the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, or TESS. What can you tell us about this craft and its mission?
Right, so TESS, as you said, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, is in some ways a follow-up to the Kepler mission. TESS is going to be looking at 200,000 of the nearest, brightest stars and looking for planets that orbit those stars, because those planets that are nearby, so within maybe 30 or 300 light years away, and a light year is the distance that it takes light to travel, the distance that light travels in 1 year. TESS is going to be looking at those planets that are nearby and bright, because those are the planets that we are going to want to study in the future to try and figure out what their atmospheres are like and if there are signatures of life that might be in those atmospheres that we can see.
Does NASA have a department devoted to coming up with acronyms? I just was curious, do you think?
There's actually a joke in astronomy about how tortured some of the acronyms are.
It seems like we work awful hard to get to something, but that was an exo question. How is that the mission of TESS different from that of Kepler?
So Kepler was basically taking a planetary census and trying to figure out what the population of planets looked like in that one star-studded patch of sky that it was staring at. And Kepler was, its primary mission was focusing on a tiny patch of sky between the constellations of Cygnus and Lyra in the north. TESS is going to be surveying about 85% of the sky and looking again at those 200,000 or so really bright stars. It's going to start by mapping the planets that are orbiting stars in the southern hemisphere, and then it's going to shift to looking for planets that are orbiting stars in the northern hemisphere. So it's going to be looking at a much broader patch of sky, basically 85% of the sky, with the goal being not so much to take a planetary census and understand the population of worlds, but to identify the worlds that are going to be the best for follow-up observations over the next decade or so.
These objects are just, I mean, they're so incredibly far away. And you said earlier the only way that Kepler was able to know that they were even there was by seeing them transit across the star. How can we find out the kinds of details we would need to know about whether they're rocky, whether they have water, and things like that? How do we find that level of detail with objects that are this far away?
Oh, that's a really good question. So missions like Kepler and like TESS can tell us the radius of a planet that's orbiting a distant star, so how wide it is. And then what we would need to do is look at those planets again with a different type of instrument that can tell us the mass of those planets. And once you have the radius and the mass, you can come up with a density. And you can compare that density to what we know of for Earth or for planets in our solar system and say, well, this world is likely to be rocky, or it's likely to be gassy, like Neptune or like Uranus. And so once you have that density, you can start to figure out, are we looking at a planet that has a surface that life might be able to walk on? Or are we looking at another type of gassy world that's just a big puffball? Mm-hmm. So that's one of the ways in which you can do that, is by doing follow-up observations and coming up with a density for the planets.
So this is like a really good detective novel.
It is, yes, it is. And so Earthlings have gotten pretty good at aiming all kinds of hardware at the sky and trying to figure out as best we can what's out there. But it does take a whole bunch of instruments to do that.
Well, back in 2009 when Kepler launched, and I think this is a really great thing to be aware of, when Kepler launched in 2009, most of us were still walking around with flip phones in our pockets. The iPad hadn't been invented yet, and we had standalone digital cameras that weren't attached to our phones. Oh my God, how did we manage to survive? Suffice it to say, technology has come a long way in the last decade. So how much of an upgrade is the technology on TESS compared to Kepler?
Well, it's a little bit, it's different. And once again, the missions are a little bit different. And so whereas Kepler was basically aiming the sharpest planet-finding eye in the sky at one little patch over 4 years, TESS has a much broader suite of instruments on board. Its cameras cover a much greater area. And instead of staring at that one tiny patch of sky for 4 years, it's basically going to be focusing on each of, I think they've divided the sky up into 26 patches. It's going to be looking at each patch for about a month at a time. And so the same basic observing technique is what the scientists are using. But again, it does have a little bit of an upgrade.
Nadia Drake is a science journalist and a contributing writer for National Geographic, where, among other things, she writes about space. What questions do you have about the hunt to find new planets? Do you follow the discoveries that have been made by the Kepler Space Telescope? What do you think we can learn about our own planet and our own place in the universe from the kinds of discoveries we are talking about here this morning? And when it comes for searching for life elsewhere, where do you think we should focus our hunt? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Nadia, is TESS already making discoveries, or will it take a while longer to get the data sent back to NASA?
It already is. So TESS launched in April of this year, and just within the last month or 6 weeks, the spacecraft's team announced that TESS had found three planets. And one of those is a little bit bigger than Earth, and it has one of the fastest periods that scientists have ever seen. It goes around its star once every 11 hours, if you can imagine that.
Wow.
So, right? So 1 year on that planet lasts for 11 hours. Which means we'd all be really old.
I'm really old already, but...
Right. So am I.
11 hours, that's amazing. I mean, how does it not just burn up? It just, you know, that's moving.
It's crazy, right? And so one of the things that Kepler has shown us, as well as some of the other exoplanet surveys, has been that the planets that exist in the cosmos are nothing like what we could have imagined before we saw them. There are types of planets that we see orbiting other stars that we just don't have anything like that in our solar system. So these planets that are snuggled in closer than the orbit of Mercury, and Mercury is the closest planet in our solar system to the sun, they are big. There's a whole population called hot Jupiters, which are giant Jupiter-sized planets that are very close to their stars, that go around their stars in a day or two, an Earth day or two. And so it's so fascinating to think about how many alien worlds are out there and how the cosmos is growing planets that the human minds probably could never have anticipated.
What's the projected lifespan of TESS's mission?
TESS's primary mission is scheduled to be 2 years in duration, and I think what scientists had predicted is that it will discover something like 20,000 transiting exoplanets over those 2 years.
Let's get a quick call in here before the news. Roosevelt is joining us from Milwaukee. Roosevelt, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I had a question. I just got in the car, so hopefully I didn't miss what I'm about to ask about. There was a report that there was a underground lake on Mars a few months back. I read about this, of water, and I wanted to know what was the latest development on that? Was there any plans to send a probe there to investigate that? And it was a few months ago I read about it.
Okay. All right. Quickly, Nadia, do you know anything about this?
I do, right. So a couple of months ago, scientists had announced that they discovered evidence for an underground, I believe it was a saline lake on Mars, a stable body of water, which if you're following developments on Mars, is a little bit surprising in that it's underground, but it's not necessarily surprising in that scientists are finding evidence for water on Mars all the time. One of the questions that emerged after that discovery is if that lake really is there, and I think everyone agrees that there needs to be some kind of follow-up work to confirm it. If that lake is there, is that a good place to go to look for life on Mars? Because it's a sheltered environment, it's protected from radiation that is continually bombarding that planet, could be temperate, it could be a stable body of water. And so far, I don't know of any missions that are being planned to go look at that lake in particular, but I know that it is piquing people's curiosity in terms of a potential underground habitable environment on another planet.
Well, if you're curious, space is a great place to look because there's a lot of curious stuff going on out there. Our conversation with Nadia Drake continues in just a little bit. She's here today to talk with us about NASA's post-Kepler plans to hunt for planets. When we come back, we'll talk about how TESS works in conjunction with other things that are also going on research-wise. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The Kepler Space Telescope has run out of fuel and been decommissioned after nearly 10 years in orbit and having been instrumental in finding more than 2,600 planets. What questions do you have about the hunt to find new planets? What do you think we can learn about our own home in the universe from these kinds of discoveries? And when it comes to searching for life elsewhere, where should we focus our hunt? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Nadia Drake is a science journalist and contributing writer for National Geographic. She was also the science writer in residence at UW-Madison in the fall of 2016. And we have a really interesting tweet I'm going to share with everybody in just a moment. But before we do that, I want to know how TESS will work in conjunction with other missions NASA has going and other space telescopes such as the Hubble.
So Hubble right now is doing a lot of the follow-up work on characterizing exoplanets that we've been talking about. So work that is trying to figure out what those planets atmospheres are made of. What are we looking at? You know, what kinds of gases are swaddling these faraway worlds? What TESS is going to do is identify the planets that we can do that kind of work with most easily because they're nearby and they're bright and we have telescopes that are able to look at them. So TESS is going to be identifying planets for follow-up, and then we have telescopes like Hubble and the Spitzer Space Telescope that can perhaps begin to do some of that follow-up characterization work. But what scientists are actually waiting for are for sharper, more sensitive instruments to come online. Things like the James Webb Space Telescope, which is now scheduled to launch, I think, in 2021, and some of the very large ground-based observatories that are now under construction, or at least planned to be under construction in the next decade. Those are the kinds of facilities that are really going to be able to do the characterization work that scientists are looking forward to.
We have a tweet from Tom. Tom tweets, did Kepler discover the TRAPPIST-1 system, and was that a big deal within that professional planet, the professional planet hunter community, as it was with the public?
So the TRAPPIST-1 system that Tom, I believe he said, is referring to is an intriguing system of planets that's orbiting a star that's quite small. It's actually not much larger than the planet Jupiter in our own solar system. And what TRAPPIST found, and that actually was not a Kepler discovery, it was found by a different team using a different telescope, which is named TRAPPIST after the Belgian beer-brewing monks. They found that around this one tiny star, there are seven Earth-sized planets.
Wow.
Three of which might be in orbits that are life-friendly, meaning that the temperatures on their surface are such that liquid water is stable. It was a mind-blowing discovery when it was found because nobody had ever imagined that you might have seven Earth-sized planets orbiting one tiny star.
That's amazing. Let's take some phone calls here. First, we'll go to Brian, who is reaching out to us from Heartland this morning. Brian, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. So, Nadia, I had read an article that I found really interesting, and that article indicated that, I forget the exact statistic, but roughly one in five exoplanets that we've discovered, there's strong evidence for large bodies of liquid water, which I think is absolutely fascinating considering how many exoplanets we're discovering, you know, yearly. So is that statistic true? And how do scientists and astronomers make that determination?
Brian, thanks for that call. There's another call with a similar question. I'm going to take them both together here. We'll go next to Matt in Nisida. Matt, good morning.
Hi there. So my question is, there are a couple moons. Europa is one of them that are suspected to have liquid water under a thick sheet of ice in our solar system. And are there any plans to visit those?
Okay, so a couple of questions there about water. How do we determine whether a planet has liquid water, and this idea that one in five of the planets we discover may have large amounts of it? How significant is that? And then Tom's question about Europa.
So to answer the first one, as far as I know, there has actually been no determination of bodies of liquid water on planets orbiting stars other than the sun. I think what you might be referring to is the estimate that astronomers have for how many of the planets in the cosmos are potentially like Earth. And so what Kepler has told us and what other surveys have also told us is that roughly one-fifth of the world's that we think are out there are potentially like Earth in that they are rocky and they're orbiting their stars at the right distance for liquid water to be stable. So it's not that we found liquid water on their surfaces yet. It's just that we think that there is a population of planets out there, roughly one-fifth of them, that might be right for liquid water to exist.
Thanks to Brian and Matt for calling in. Let's take a call next from Mike, who joins us from Waukesha. Mike, good morning.
Hi. I got a couple of questions. Number one is, how with Kepler, how can he distinguish between like a sunspot and a planet? And my second question is, what would it take to do direct imaging of an exoplanet?
Great question. So when Kepler is looking at these things transiting a star, how do we know what's the difference between that and a sunspot?
That's a really good question. And that's one of the issues that the Kepler team actually had, was they found that the stars in their sample were a lot noisier than our sun. So they chose a sample of stars that they thought were going to be sun-like. And what they found was that the stars there they're behaving much more differently than our sun did and does. And so one of the things that they had to do was figure out whether what they were seeing was stellar noise or the footprint of a planet. And the footprint of a planet is going to be something that's periodic. You would expect to see it recurring at a particular frequency. Star spots, I believe, are more variable. But again, this is one of those areas in which astronomers are working really hard to try and remove the noise that's caused by normal stellar spots, by normal stellar oscillations. So that's actually a really, really good question. I don't know the details of the answer.
Well, and then his second question was, what would it take to actually get direct images of these exoplanets?
We have a few images of exoplanets already. But if we really, really want to be able to see one of these planets, they're all so far away that we would actually need to send a camera there if you want to get details of what's on their surface. Or astronomers are currently designing instruments that would be able to directly image the planets, meaning that we could see light shining through these planets. And the way to do that would be to block the light from the star that they're orbiting. And these are instruments that we don't quite have up and running yet, but there are some that are returning preliminary images of exoplanets. It's a really, really tough problem to crack.
Lately, there's been a lot of talk of a so-called Planet 9 or even Planet X, which sounds kind of like something from the title of a 1950s science fiction movie. But moving on, astronomers suspect that there's a large planet hiding out in the distant fringes of our solar system, but they can't seem to actually locate it. Now, we've been talking about exoplanets this morning, ones that are really, really, really far away. But is looking for this planet that's a little closer to home also part of NASA's mission?
There are several teams of astronomers right now that are gearing up to search the sky for Planet 9 or 10 or X or whatever you want to call it. And what they're doing is they're using essentially telescopes in Hawaii that are super sharp and sensitive and looking for this planet in the region of the sky where they've predicted that it will be. It's really interesting. And the fact that there might be a large planet lurking in the depths of the solar system that we still haven't managed to see is intriguing.
Well, I mean, I know I'm oversimplifying this, massively oversimplifying this, but why can we find planets that are so far away, hundreds of light years, and yet we can't seem to find this potential planet in our own solar system? What's the difference in the way we search and what are the complications here?
So we find planets that are far away, again, by looking for the footprints that they leave as they pass across the faces of their stars, so the dips in starlight. We can also detect them by looking for the effects of their gravity on those distant stars. So planets tug on their stars as they orbit. And those are the two primary methods that we use to find planets that are far away. This planet in our solar system, we will never see crossing the face of our sun because it doesn't orbit interior to Earth. And it's going to be difficult to detect its gravitational tug on the sun as well. And so what astronomers are doing is they're basically looking for a very, very incredibly faint pinprick of light that's moving across the sky in an orbit that I think they've calculated to take thousands and thousands and thousands of years. So it's moving very slowly. So they're basically taking images of star fields and looking for one tiny faint dot that's moving along a projected path.
The proverbial needle in a haystack, and this haystack is constantly expanding. We've been talking primarily about NASA here, but we know that American space endeavors are no longer limited to that agency. Are private companies like SpaceX getting in on this planet hunt as well?
I don't actually know if SpaceX has plans to be looking for planets. My understanding of SpaceX goals was more that they wanted to send people to planets, by which I mean Mars, but also plans to send humans around the moon for the first time in about 50 years.
Really? Well, that would be exciting.
Well, I agree.
Nadia Drake, maybe you can go on one of those missions, you know.
Have
yourself launched into space.
As long as it's a round trip.
that would be the big deal, yes. Nadia Drake, science journalist, contributing writer for National Geographic, and a writer about space. Thank you for joining us this morning on The Morning Show. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. First responders encounter people in a range of mental and physical states in the course of their work, whether the first people on a scene are law enforcement officers or medical personnel, and it can have a big impact on how people showing symptoms of a condition called excited delirium are dealt with. Haley Sperling is an engagement editor and reporter with WisContext, and her most recent piece is Examining the Emergency Medical Playbook for Treating Excited Delirium. It's a follow-up to a piece on excited delirium she wrote in June. Both articles can be found at wiscontext.org. Ideas Network producer Chris Molina recently spoke with Haley Sperling about the topic.
This is your second article looking at this idea of excited delirium. Remind us what that means.
So excited delirium is a essentially a medical condition that exhibits itself in individual, oftentimes dealing with either drug overdose, withdrawals, or any sort of mental health problems. Its symptoms generally include almost superhuman strength, body temperature increases, a kind of lack of response to general requests. So basically, it's kind of your body overheating, and then eventually, if left unchecked, it can shut down.
Is there a medically agreed upon definition here or not?
It's an interesting question because it's something that's really debated between the medical community and the law enforcement community. So law enforcement and EMS medical examiners generally accept it as a real medical condition, but it has been hotly debated, especially recently, because a lot of groups see it as more so a way for people to sort of cover their tracks. Excited delirium is typically used in cases of police use of force. So if a taser is used, if someone is taken down physically and then they inevitably die from those injuries, excited delirium has been noted as a cause of death. But, its history comes about more so from the 1980s when it was used to describe cocaine overdoses in individuals. So, they'd get that really rapid heartbeat, sweating, the superhuman strength, and then just suddenly kind of crash. But now we see it with these use of force cases where people have these symptoms exhibiting, but then are hit by a taser and inevitably succumb to those injuries.
So you talked about how the police use this, but in your most recent piece, you look at the issue of first responders in particular, who might be a police officer, might be an EMT worker, and how they deal with situations when they encounter an emotionally disturbed person, is the term, or an EDP. What did you learn about the protocols that are in place for first responders here?
So essentially what happens is that, when police get a call, they really just have to listen to what is going on in the situation. So one of the main sources that I talked to just said it's really important right away to identify the situation as if you find out that you're dealing with an EDP or someone dealing with excited delirium, that it's important to get the EMS team on the scene right away, because they'll be the ones who are able to actually administer the drugs and medicine to calm the person down. But oftentimes police are the first responders on the scene. So it's really up to them to calm the situation down, try and talk to this person, even though, they might not be in the proper emotional state to have a functioning conversation. But they're really in charge of kind of controlling the scene, making sure that there isn't a danger to themselves, anyone around the area, and that this person can be kind of subdued in an easier way. Police really, they, in their training guidelines and all the guidelines that I looked over for this reporting, they mention calling EMS right away, so getting emergency medical teams on the scene, and then also using softer restraint practices. So, not putting these people in handcuffs right away or something that could make them even further agitated and further elevate their heart rate or body temperature, which can all be really dangerous to that person in that situation.
And I'm curious, too, you mentioned training. I'm wondering how much training is taking place about excited delirium, and where is that training coming from?
So for a lot of these first responders, it's part of their required courses. For EMS training, it's a required subject matter for people wanting to go into that field to have to deal with this. There's also different groups across the state that help with this training. So one of them that I had spoken to for this article was the Crisis Intervention Training Team, which is hosted more or less by NAMI Wisconsin, which helps deal and, educate the general population about mental illnesses and different mental health strategies. So what the CIT team does, they come in and they'll work with police departments or with EMS schools and help train people on handling these high stress situations. And this is about a 40-hour training with the CIT team.
We are talking right now with Haley Sperling. She's an engagement editor and reporter with WisConText, and her most recent piece is Examining the Emergency Medical Playbook for Treating Excited Delirium. And Haley, with the training and the protocols that we have been talking about, are these aimed at protecting the victims? Are they aimed at protecting the first responders or a little bit of both?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because, you know, it really comes to the entire picture. You know, you want the person, you know, suffering from this ailment to be safe. You want them to be okay. But then again, you don't want any of the officers or first responders on the scene to get hurt along the way or any possible bystanders to get injured along the way. So one thing that police do when they get on the scene, you know, right after discovering that, okay, this is an excited delirium case or this is a person who is emotionally disturbed, you know, after they call EMS, they try and, you know, secure the scene and make sure that any other people who could be put in harm's way are out of that way. And again, they're, you know, trying to use softer restraint tactics. So, you know, having multiple people or multiple first responders rather on the scene can help, you know, neutralize the individual in question without having to deploy any sort of tasers or anything like that. So what the police are really trying to do is calm everyone down, wait until EMS comes, and then EMS can come and actually, you know, administer ketamine or, you know, haloperidol is something that's used as well to really physically calm someone down.
And in writing these articles, do you see any movement towards more informed and consistent responses in these situations?
You know, I think it's an interesting question because it's something that changes. You know, these protocols are examined all the time and, you know, these all the sources I've talked to, you know, they're constantly looking at new technology and, you know, we live in a world that's constantly changing and developing every day, so they have to go with that. But generally across the board, the training has remained relatively the same. You know, it's getting someone on the scene, it's calling EMS, there's, you know, some minor discrepancies between drugs that are used, but overall it's a lot of ketamine, a lot of haloperidol. So I think people have kind of come to the consensus on what works and what doesn't. But, you know, like I've said in the past, there's always room for things to grow and change because, you know, these are professionals who are staying on top of the field and, you know, they're just trying to do the best work that they can. But, you know, that's every situation is different, so it can kind of just come down to the situation at hand.
And as we said, this was the second article that you wrote for WisContext looking at this concept. Do you have any additional plans to follow up on this reporting?
Yeah, so thanks for asking. there's actually going to be another article in the works. So one thing about excited delirium is that, you know, in past interviews I've mentioned that it's not recognized by the APA or the AMA. It's also not listed in the DSM-5, I believe, or ICD-10, which are basically just the manuals that professionals use as the baseline to diagnose mental illnesses as well as just physical diseases. So when excited delirium is listed as a cause of death, it has to be categorized as something else because, like I said, the ICD-10 does not list excited delirium as an actual ailment. So it's not like a medical examiner can write down the corresponding number. They're going to be writing something else. So I'm trying to look into what is actually or what excited delirium is being coded as when it is listed as a cause of death and trying to find out how many times that code has been used in the state of Wisconsin and just kind of go from there and see how many times this has actually happened and what people in the medical community are really calling it when it comes down to the actual technicality of it.
All right. Haley, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Ideas Network producer Chris Molina speaking with WisContext editor and reporter Haley Sperling about her most recent article on the topic of excited delirium. You can find this article and more at wiscontext.org. The Morning Show is produced by Sarah Hopeful, Chris Molina, Colleen Leahy, Laura Pavin, Rhymes, and Jana Rose Schleiss. Rianne Chasso and Kaylee Boltina is executive producer. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network.